And it's time. It's time that Israel finally got brought to justice. We've seen enough horror, murder, oppression, occupation, ethnic cleansing. Enough. We've had enough.
The last time Palestine Action tried to close Elbit's Lester site was 2 years ago. This time, they say, they won't leave until they have finished the job. Saeed Pariza, London.
It has become a well-trodden political path. Press TV being attacked in the British Parliament. This time, the mouthpiece was the vice chair of the Conservatives' Friends of Israel.
A shocking report into the online activities of Press TV, particularly their use of a video series called Palestine Declassified, which focuses its hatred on British Jews. Whilst Press TV may be banned from our airways, this foreign state hate operation is continuing online. Can we have a debate at some point on what more we can do to ensure that social media platforms tackle this outrageous content?
In the decade and a half since it was established, Press TV has found itself front and center of Western media attacks. But despite the pressure, the channel continues to advocate for the voiceless, chief amongst them, the Palestinians. The show at the heart of the latest onslaught is Palestine Declassified. Its host, former Labour MP Chris Williamson, gave his take on why the show was such a bone of contention for the pro-Israel lobby.
What we've seen here is a shameless attempt by the Israel lobby in the House of Parliament to whitewash Israel's criminality and lawlessness. And of course, they're very concerned about the fact that Palestine Declassified is shining a light into the murky corners of Israel's activities and indeed on the lobby that seeks to avoid any criticism of their suppression of the Palestinian people. Palestine Declassified is, you know, very effective. It scrupulously researches all of the content that we put out. And obviously, you know, they're embarrassed by the truth that we are bringing to a wider public. And of course, you know, the traction that Palestine Declassified is now picking up, it's been suggested, reaching well over 11 million people now. So they're doing their damnedest now, it seems to me, to try and close down our success.
Chris has written a stern letter rebuking some of the smears parroted by Andrew Percy.
There's no truth whatsoever to the allegations that you made. I mean, it suggested that, you know, we sort of are a vehicle for hatred towards British Jews. I mean, the programme is doesn't sort of promote hate in any respect, or it suggested anyway, that he should consider apologising for maligning me and for impugning the reputation of Palestine Declassified and Press TV.
As Palestinians continue to live under an oppressive regime, Press TV's fight to advocate for justice will see it targeted as part of Israel's campaign to close down anyone who stands up for the Palestinian cause, a move branded media terrorism. Amina Taylor, London.
The members of the Pakistani parliament are insisting the coalition government to eliminate obstacles in starting the oil trade with neighboring Iran to overcome the country's energy deficiency. MPs' voices were heard during the recent meetings of the parliamentary committees, in which lawmakers stressed upon the government officials to robust diplomacy for aggressively pursuing options to secure waivers on the oil trade with Iran.
We get 1 million liters of diesel from Iran every day. It's called so-called smuggling. And it's, I think, 50 rupees per liter as compared to here. We should open this up. The region has to open up.
The lawmakers recommended that all-out efforts should be made to secure waivers from sanctions on oil trade with Iran.
I've been saying to the government also that we should open up these borders. Because, like, for the first time, Iran-Afghanistan trade is more than Pakistan-Afghanistan trade. And I think if they can have it, and it's benefiting both countries, so this trade would be very good for us also.
According to the data provided by Pakistan's Commerce Ministry to the Parliament, Pakistan's trade with Iran has crossed over $2 billion, covering food, medicines, cotton, and pharmaceutical products.
This is a huge project. We are engaged in talks with Pakistani authorities over this issue, and both countries will manage to come up with a positive solution very soon.
Like the rest of the world, Pakistan is no exception to the global energy crisis, which is worsening with each passing day. Experts say Islamabad plans to buy oil and gas from Iran, but wants to do in such a way that it escapes sanctions from the US and other Western countries.
Although the bilateral trade between Iran and Pakistan has now reached over $2 billion, however, both sides believe that more efforts should be made to strengthen the trade relations further and to support the business community of the two countries. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Turkish Defense Minister Hulusi Akar said there are positive signs that Turkey and Syria could be close to reaching an agreement that would facilitate the return of 3.6 million Syrian refugees to home. Akar talked about the meeting that took place in Moscow between him and Syrian Defense Minister Ali Mahmoud Abbas with the participation of Iranian and Russian counterparts. The Turkish minister said things will not be solved in one meeting after 11 years of strained relations. However, he says both sides are aware that through dialogue they can find common ground.
We got together with the Syrian defense minister for the first time in 11 years. It was an important meeting. Dialogue is the key. Both sides acknowledge this. It is, of course, not possible to resolve everything at once. Naturally, the parties may have maximalist demands, but we are trying to turn those demands into reasonable ones.
Damascus says its main demand is for Turkish troops to leave the Syrian territory, with officials repeating in every meeting that the road to normalization can only be paved by the withdrawal of thousands of Turkish troops from the Arab country. This point was again raised in last week's meeting and stressed by the Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad. He said it is impossible to talk about normalization as the Turkish army continues to occupy Syria's northern areas. But Turkey says its presence in Syria is aimed at fighting terrorism and creating a safe environment for the Syrian people, as well as protecting shared borders, which is Turkey's main concern. Turkey is also worried from a new round of clashes, which could lead to a new wave of refugees.
Both sides have their demands. The Turkish side wants security guarantees. They don't want to see any type of autonomous structure in the northeast of Syria that is led by the YPG group. This is a major security concern for Turkey. And Turkey also has almost 4 million Syrian refugees that it would like to slowly see repatriated in the future. We're still far apart on the demands from both sides for normalization, but this doesn't mean that both sides can't come together on a transactional basis to try to further issues that are of mutual interest.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has hoped that he can reach an agreement with Syria before the upcoming presidential and parliamentary election. Sending refugees back is one of the Turkish people's main concerns, and opposition parties are playing the card of Syrian refugees against Erdogan in their campaigns. A normalization of relations between Ankara and Damascus will definitely ease the pressure on Turkey, whether regarding the refugee crisis or armed groups operating in Syria that Turkey sees as terrorists. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Iran has successfully tested a homegrown plane engine and its control system. The engine was built by experts of Mapna Industrial Group using the reverse engineering method. The testing process was observed by Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, who was visiting the company on the occasion of the International Workers' Day. Raisi visited an exhibition on Mapna Group's technological achievements in the fields of thermal and renewable energy power plants, oil and gas, rail transportation, air engines, electric cars, and so forth. During his visit, the Iranian president praised the company, saying he is proud of the efforts made by skilled workers and experts of Mapna.
We must be proud of this level of work, endeavor, creativity, innovation, skill, knowledge, and technology. Truly, this company is one of the industrial groups that have made us proud. It has also made our country more powerful. They have accomplished a lot, and they have lots of important projects that will be completed in the future.
Daisy described the achievements as significant, saying the company's productions are quality enough to be sold on regional and global markets. In 2022, the Mapna Group won an award for being one of the top three Iranian exporters of the year. In July, the company's technology and engineering exports topped 2.5 billion euros.
The major achievements of the Mapna Industrial Group have once again proved that sanctions cannot hinder Iran's development. Iranians have time and again shown that where there is a will, there is a way. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Paris was on fire for May Day, International Workers' Day, once again. Hundreds were arrested, hundreds were hurt, and tear gas was a constant for hours. The demonstration route was littered with broken glass and fires after cops repeatedly intervened in the march. Protesters targeted banks, insurance vendors, real estate agencies, and sexist advertising, and then the end of the march turned into a multi-hour battle royale.
Tear gas is sadly typical of how our government deals with political demonstrations. French democracy has been tarnished worldwide and appears ridiculous, as it's clearly not based on representative democracy.
Over 2 million people marched nationwide as unions declared May Day the 13th major day of protest this year against a 2-year hike to the pension age, which was rammed into law by executive decree last month. The undemocratic proclamation of the law, combined with the shocking police brutality, had many French people questioning their country's democratic bona fides.
France allows for demonstrations, but the problem is that police don't allow it. We saw that with the yellow vests, and we have seen it again from the very start of the pension protests this year.
Macron has to stop showing such contempt for the people. As a yellow vest, I promise that we will never stop fighting for a real democracy. We want referendums and public participation, while Macron only has fear for the people.
International Workers' Day began in Chicago in 1886 with the fight for an 8-hour workday. It wouldn't be implemented in the West until after their political and financial elites forced World War I, which was largely an effort to maintain monarchical privileges and to forestall socialist-inspired reforms. Protesters insist they can apply enough pressure on the president to get the unpopular law revoked, something protests also forced in 2006. Press TV's cameraman was hit by a tear gas grenade fired by police seconds before the start of a live interview from the demonstration. It appears like a clear case of police targeting media, as tear gas is normally shot high into the air. The cameraman was not badly hurt, as the projectile only exploded after it ricocheted off his leg. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
It goes under the technical name of European Stability Mechanism, or ESM. It is the Eurozone bailout fund designed to help euro area countries in severe financial distress. The first ESM version was devised in 2012 following Greece's default on its own bonds, which brought the Eurozone at risk of breaking apart, with economic instability spreading across the old continent. As Europe faces several challenges to stay afloat, the European Union must devise mechanisms to balance its member states economically. The European Stability Mechanism is a rescue fund for EU member countries that have lost or risk losing market access. In practical terms, it grants conditional financial assistance to states that are on the verge of bankruptcy to mitigate the contagion risks in the bloc.
We, of course, need to remain vigilant. Economic uncertainty remains high and we face numerous headwinds. Events in the US support the EU's choice to apply the Basel Prudential Standards to all our banks, not just the largest one.
In early 2021, the European Commission and all members of the bloc signed a new agreement amending the previous ESM in a way that it prevents small crises from escalating. On Friday, European Economy Commissioner Paolo Gentiloni called on Rome to stop dragging its heels over ratification of the reform. As of today, all EU member countries have ratified the reform, except Italy.
By holding out on ratifying the reform, Italy is maybe attempting to fetch a better deal on the upcoming reform of the EU's set of fiscal rules. Some are even suggesting that parties in Italy's ruling coalition are caught in some sort of political skirmishes over this issue.
On several occasions, Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has criticized the ESM reform, arguing that the bailout funds should be used also as a vehicle for growth. Some time ago, the leader of one of the right-leaning coalition government's parties, the League's Matteo Salvini, said that approving the ESM changes would mean the ruining of lives for millions of Italians and the end of Italy's national sovereignty on budget issues.
Creating wealth to tackle poverty is our top priority, as Italy has already sold many of its strategic assets and made a huge amount of debt. We must focus on investing now.
While Brussels is urging Italy's approval of the European Stability Mechanism, the examination of the bills for its ratification has been at a standstill in the Italian Parliament for almost a month. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward. and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It is the first visit by an Iranian president to Syria since the war on Syria began. The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, has visited the country with much fanfare. A long-term cooperation agreement and a major oil deal have been signed already. The question is, why has Iran decided now is the time for this visit? And in that context, what does the forging of closer ties between the two countries mean for the entire region, especially since Syria is being embraced back into the fold by other Arab countries? Those are some of the questions we'll be asking from our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. Let me bring in Mick Napier first, activist and commentator, who joins us from Edinburgh. Mick Napier, welcome. So let me first initially get your reaction to this, because this is an important visit that has been done at this point. It's a two-day visit by the Iranian president since the war on Syria began back in the year 2011. What's your impression of it?
Well, the Americans have seized a part of Syria, which, surprise, surprise, contains most of the most valuable oil resources. America's trying to isolate and overthrow the regime in Damascus. It's ratcheting up pressure on Iran. It's trying to build alliances across the Middle East to isolate these two states in order to either achieve regime change or to bend them to the American will. I think the visit by the Iranian leader to Damascus is a symptom of something radically changing in the Middle East. We all saw how China was able to effect a reconciliation between Iran and Saudi Arabia. We've seen the knock-on effects of that in Yemen already. But certainly in Syria, we can see that the efforts by the USA to isolate and force its allies in the Middle East to isolate Syria are breaking down. Saudi Arabians are working for rapprochement with Damascus. There's talks about reintegrating Damascus into the Arab League. And I think this visit from Tehran to Damascus talks of this is a symptom of this new situation where American power in the region is clearly declining, and its ability to enforce its will, divide and isolate the key countries in the region against each other, is faltering, is actually failing. So it's a visit greatly to be welcomed.
You know, when you first started talking about, when I asked that question, McNapier, you talked about the U.S. goals, which was to ratchet up pressure on Iran going for regime change. But, you know, these are things and approaches that have failed, as you just said there in your last statement there. Why do you think the U.S. is clinging on to it? Because if you really think about it, which countries are on the U.S. side right now? You have all the, you know, the allies that were mainly Saudi Arabia being one of the major ones, who's no longer on the side of the U.S. when it comes to Syria. The only entity that is standing out is the Zionist regime or Israel and U.S. All the other countries are uniting. So doesn't that put the U.S. in an odd position, to say the least?
I mean, what a transformation over the last couple of decades. America really believed it could invade, crush the Iraqi people, could crush the Syrian people. And its whole idea was kind of mapped out as early as the end of the Second World War, where a key American diplomat said that Middle Eastern oil was, quote unquote, the greatest prize in the history of the world. And America was determined to dominate access to that oil. It installed a puppet regime in Iran, together with the British. It installed client regimes across the Middle East, because its idea was basically very simple. It's not that America needs the oil. America's often a net exporter of oil. But if it could control access to that oil, then it would exert tremendous influence on it, on Japan and China and other places around the world who wanted access to that key resource. Now, fast forward to the present day, the carefully crafted alliances, the day when Saudi Arabia would bend over backwards, with very few exceptions, but would bend over backwards to please the Americans, those days seem to be gone. And I think the view from Washington now is that the Chinese mediation between Tehran and Riyadh was really contemptuous of the USA, and it did not give the dominant imperial power in the region since the Second World War, it didn't give that power its due place. So yes, the tectonic plates of regional politics are shifting, and they're not shifting to the advantage of the USA.
And in a sense, when you take a look at what has happened based on how you said a tectonic shift, you know, these regional alliances, you wouldn't think of it even months ago, because when you had this agreement and reconciliation between Iran and Saudi Arabia take place, I mean, I don't know if we can believe the CIA chief or not, but he said that the U.S. was, in a sense, blindsided. But what's more important over here is a terminology that the U.S. Would hate for it to stand, but now it's stronger probably than ever, and that's this axis of resistance, which Syria is now back in the fold of the Arab countries and has solidified itself in that respect. How do you think the U.S. feels when it looks at what has occurred there? And to add to that, we have seen how Saudi Arabia, possibilities of Saudi Arabia not only reconciling with Hamas, but also in the past day or two, for there to have been some positive overtures when it comes to Hezbollah. I'm sure Israel is not too happy to hear this.
What a transformation. Back in 2006, when Hezbollah scored an astonishing victory over the Israelis, denied the Israelis victory, the overwhelmingly superior military force through the courage and the intelligence and the strategic and tactical brilliance of its fighters. When that defeat was inflicted upon Israel, the word in among knowledgeable individuals was that the Saudis were very unhappy and were hoping for a Hezbollah defeat. Now, I wasn't there in the Chancellery, so I don't know, but that's certainly not the case anymore. Look, every time an Arab state normalizes with the apartheid regime in Israel, they pay a price with their own public opinion, which never follows them. The Egyptians have had a so-called peace treaty with Israel since for many decades, but it's a cold peace, and the Egyptian people, in their overwhelming majority, disapprove of it and want to see the Egyptian regime challenge, stand with the Palestinians against Israel. So yeah, this is remarkable. I think the idea is, the question is, who will control the resources of the region? I think America has probably given up in its original plan to control those resources and to admit friendly regimes on preferential terms to those resources, whether they be in Iran under the Shah, in Iraq under American occupation, or in Syria or elsewhere. I think that plan is in ruins. It now has to try to sow... America's not like Israel. They're very different. But Israel can only exist as a state of 10 million Zionist Jews, a Jewish supremacist state, against the entire people of the region, 280, 300 million people. I mean, it should never exist because it's so tiny and weak.
Right.
It can only exist with an air bridge of arms and weapons and economic advantage from the USA and Europe, but also by devastating neighboring countries, by making sure that neighboring countries in the Middle East are weak and broken, as was the attempt with Iraq, as was the attempt on Syria and elsewhere. So any coming together of local forces in the Middle East, states and other actors who want to see local control of this, of key local resources, who want to develop the Middle East, as China has developed in the last 50, 60 years. China used to be a basket case. China used to be a land of famine and hunger and different countries seizing parts of China. But China has developed and has become a major world power. People in the Middle East who want to share in the wealth of this wonderful planet, who don't want to live under foreign subjugation, who don't want to be suffering the threat of attack by Israel, by America's little Prussia, America's little Sparta, America's nuclear-armed Israel. Those people who want freedom and a better life for themselves through local control of resources seem to be winning very much against the American grand plan.
Sure.
If you take the long view.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, let me bring in my political analyst, John Busnich, into the program and get his thoughts on this. John Busnich, welcome to the Spotlight.
Thank you.
Let's take a look at what has happened over here when you take a look at this visit. And I want to come at you with the regional landscape of which, when you take a look at the map and you take a look at the countries and how they've aligned themselves with each other, of course, Iran and Saudi Arabia being the big ones, of which then the rest somewhat followed, in a sense, you're only left with U.S. and the Zionist regime or Israel vis-a-vis the rest, especially when it comes to Syria. Tell us how Iran, especially in this visit, has solidified its relationship with Syria as the rest of the Arab countries are bringing Syria back into the fold, and then putting into question the U.S. presence. And of course, in that context, maybe you could put Israel in there as to how it's bombing Syria every other day, it seems.
Well, you know, reality has finally arrived in the Middle East because with the assistance of China, the main consumer now of the oil and gas products of the region. We see China trying to secure a stable economic output that is not affected by the divide and conquer politics of the United States. The United States was trying to play Saudi Arabia off against Iran to try to break Iran's contact with China and with Russia. The United States has failed miserably in this effort, and the United States itself was being used as an actor by the Israel lobby, which we know is the most powerful lobby in Washington and which literally controls the majority of both political parties in the United States.
But McNapp here, there was a major cooperation agreement signed. It was called the Long-Term Strategic Cooperation. At the same time, you had a large Iranian delegation that accompanied the Iranian President Raisi in different fields like oil, aviation, railways, and agriculture. You have these Arab countries that are interested in investing in Syria, and Iran's president made it a point to talk about how it is interested, obviously, in the reconstruction. But how can any of this happen? Maybe Iran shouldn't be put into this question in that respect. When you have the U.S. and the sanctions against Syria, or sanctions against Iran for that matter, because some of these Arab countries, they're not under sanctions. So how can this part of the puzzle be solved in order for Syria to really stand on its own two feet economically and for trade to pursue?
You know, the issue of sanctions is reaching such a stage now that the last figure I saw was that America and its allies were sanctioning about 30% of the countries of the world. I believe, for example, that an American British delegation with absolute temerity went to Kazakhstan last week to threaten the government there that if they continue to trade with Russia, they themselves would suffer sanctions from America and Britain and the EU. So the sanctions have become so broad that they've forced other countries to look for alternatives to the US dollar for their bilateral trading, and this seems to be becoming pretty significant, at least in terms of an article I read in the Financial Times recently. I'm not an expert, but it seems that, the sanctions are a weapon of war. Sanctions or pre-war, sanctions were used against Iraq to famously or infamously kill 500,000 Iraqi children before the US invaded. And sanctions are being used to cripple countries, to inflict terrible punishment upon people from Cuba to Venezuela to Syria and elsewhere. And it's the imperial power and its allies which are inflicting this punishment. But it basically comes down to the threat of, if you will not be my friend, then I will punch your face. That's a paraphrase of a German proverb. It's threats and violence which are used, because the USA knows that in terms of producing goods, America was the humming workshop of the world after 1945. Now it's China. China is far and away, and neighboring countries, the biggest manufacturing pole in the world. And that's changed the balance. So America can only deal with its decline, its relative decline economically, by using military power and threatening the use of military power. And it does so very promiscuously. So any alliance across the region, in the region, between complementary economies in the region, benefits the people of the region, and it means that the American shadow hanging over the region becomes that bit less dark.
Well, something's got to be figured out there, because isn't it just John Bosnich when Iran signs, for example, a major oil deal with Syria, but you have the U.S. stealing Syrian oil? You know, that just doesn't make sense. And then making money off of it, I'm not too sure where that money is going, really. But, that's just one of the things that's just perplexing.
America is showing itself to be the hypocrite of all hypocrites here. America is the country that is telling the world that it supports free trade and competition and free enterprise. And yet it is the single biggest block to free competition and free enterprise that exists on the earth. America has all of these countries under sanctions because it wants to use economics to dictate politics to other countries. It also wants to dictate culture and ethnic relations between nations which have been friends among themselves and lived and coexisted in peace for generations and centuries and even millennia until America came and set them at each other's throats. America has inherited the English curse of divide and conquer in the interests of their empire. And the world is now smartening up to this. We cannot be allowed to be forced to fight among ourselves. I was here in Serbia during the crippling sanctions that America used to try and crush Serbia. They had no effect. The people banded together. I was in Japan when America was sanctioning Japan and I was advising the Prime Minister's office. They did not cow Japan. Japan continued to produce. I have been in Canada when American interests imposed sanctions on our wood industry. America is the global bully. And as the nations of the world wake up to this fact, the bully, when it's outnumbered by all countries in the earth, will fail and fall. And this is how empires fall. This is the fall of America. They, by sanctioning the world, are sanctioning themselves.
Well, John Busnich, I need to ask you how then this will impact the relationship that some of these Persian Gulf countries have. For example, how will Saudi Arabia be impacted by this, or the UAE? When it comes to their interest in rebuilding Syria, for example, making investments in regional countries, including Iran, isn't that kind of a sign that it's the beginning of some kind of divergence in their relationship away from the U.S.?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the critical player in this matter, because this is an economic issue, sanctions are an economic tool to achieve a political goal. And China is now the richest economy, the fastest growing economy, the most vibrant and competitive economy in the world. And it is not subject to American pressures. These countries must trade with each other. And what America is doing with its sanctions regime is forcing the other countries of the world to band together for their own mutual survival. Given a choice between survival and profit, everybody will choose survival. That leaves America out in the cold, and it leaves the rest of the world to find substitute products to replace the things they bought from America. And if America sanctions them further, then the Russian and Chinese and Iranian and Libyan and Venezuelan economies and others will band together to cut off the things that America needs from the rest of the world. And when it doesn't get those things, America will collapse.
And final question goes to you, Mick Napier. As we've discussed, if we're looking at all these countries to solidify their relationship, such as Saudi Arabia and Iran, as they are doing, along with Iran and other countries, and all of them really, to be on the one side, how can Israel then pursue its bombing campaign of Syria? Shouldn't Israel be intimidated by the fact that you have all these countries now, and they're interested in enhancing their relationship, and in the case of Syria, Israel continues to bomb them? Doesn't that put a wedge between, let's say, these countries and Israel, obviously some of which there is one, and will that make Israel think twice when it comes to bombing Syria?
Well, I mean, the price that we pay for American military adventures is massively high. They've just been kicked out of Afghanistan, but America paid or invested or spent $2.3 trillion in order to devastate Afghanistan, install a kleptocracy, and finally, after devastating the country, be expelled. So there's a high price to be paid to defeat these adventures. But Israel is a microcosm of America in many ways. It simply uses violence to enforce its will. America has always used violence. Bill Clinton apologized to the people of Central America some years ago for turning the whole place into a charnel house. America invades more countries in the world than any other, than the rest of the countries put together. So it's extremely violent, and so is Israel. But with the decline of American power in the region, with its American attention to the Pacific, Israel will become weaker. But it will not abandon its position willingly. It will try to enforce its will. And the danger is it may try and seize the opportunity before it becomes weaker to expel the Palestinians. So there's dangers ahead.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, John Busnish, journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belgrade. Thank you. And Mick Napier, activist and commentator from Edinburgh. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the Limelight.
In Britain, anti-monarchy groups are saying the call for public allegiance to King Charles III is offensive and contemptible. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The US broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Britons are gearing up for the upcoming coronation ceremony of King Charles III in the coming days. Amid an anti-monarchical pressure group, UK Republic is set to hold a massive demonstration at Trafalgar Square in central London. Termed as a political movement that seeks to replace the United Kingdom's monarchy with an elected head of state, the protesters are set to hit the streets in yellow T-shirts and placards that would read, "Not My King," a protest slur coined by the Republic group. Ryan King, who plans to take part in the protests on the historic royal occasion, said, "The monarchy has no place in modern society given how outdated and undemocratic it is." As Britons struggle with high cost of living, Graham Smith, Republic's chief executive, sees it as a perfect opportunity to crowd the roads on the day when the king would be crowned. Graham Smith said, "People are far more critical generally of our political system, which comes into this whole debate not just about the royals, but about the condition under government and parliament." Graham Smith added, "They're far more willing to listen and engage, and they're far less interested in the royals." The invitation to the protest on republic.org.uk website read, "We want to create a sea of yellow. We will be bringing lots of placards, but you can bring your own too. Make them yellow, and we are asking everyone to wear yellow on that day." "Not My King" slogan has emerged as a signatory slogan that gained popularity, as it has been extensively used throughout the time whenever King Charles III has passed by throughout his outdoor trips. Ever since the death of Queen Elizabeth II, public support for the monarchy has nosedived to a record low. Just a few days ago, a new groundbreaking study revealed that only 3 out of 10 Britons believe that a monarchy is very important. The new survey by the National Centre for Social Research claimed that 29% of those quizzed said the monarchy was very important, 26% said it was quite important, 20% said it was not very important, and 25% said it was not at all important, or it should be abolished. Both Ryan King and Graham Smith are expecting supporters to be spread out along the route, with about 1,000 at Trafalgar Square to chant, "Not My King," as King Charles III passes by. We'll be right back. Journal website has also covered this story and tells us more. A British anti-monarchy group has slammed calls on Britons to swear allegiance to King Charles III during his coronation as an insult to the British people. The remark was made on Sunday, 30th of April, by Graham Smith, a spokesman for the campaign group known as The Republic, which advocates replacement of the United Kingdom's monarchy with a parliamentary republic. Graham Smith said the plans to ask the public to pledge their allegiance to King Charles III during the coronation are offensive, tone-deaf, and a gesture that holds the people in contempt. Smith added, "In a democracy, it is the head of state who should be swearing allegiance to the people, not the other way round." King Charles III's coronation ceremony is slated to take place on 6th to 8th of May. The Republic's tirade came after the office of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, who will lead the ceremony at Westminster Abbey, called on all the British people to swear allegiance to the new king. So far, only the British nobility were expected to kneel before the king and pledge their allegiance to him. The campaign group has announced plans to hold a massive demonstration at London's Trafalgar Square on Saturday, 6th of May, to mount pressure on the royalty and their loyalists. The protesters are said to hit the streets in yellow T-shirts and placards that would read, "Not my king," a protest slur coined by the group. Earlier in January, the group announced another plan for a peaceful demonstration at Parliament Square, which is overlooked by Westminster Abbey, where King Charles III is to be crowned. Graham Smith said at the time, "The coronation is a celebration of hereditary power and privilege, and it has no place in modern British society." He also blasted the event's astronomical price tag, saying, "At a cost of tens of millions of pounds, this pointless piece of theatre is a slap in the face for millions of British people struggling with the cost of living crisis." The expensive ceremony comes as the latest figures show the UK's inflation rate stands at over 10%, the highest in the past four decades. The inflationary spiral is growing at a much faster pace than the average pay rise across the country, with food prices skyrocketing almost 20%. Increasing energy prices along with soaring energy costs have also largely contributed to Britain's cost of living crisis. Many labour unions have launched industrial action to press the government to enact salary hikes. The government, however, refuses to increase salaries, saying it would increase the rate of inflation. Experts, however, blame the existing crisis on Britain's leadership incompetence that saw the country change several prime ministers over the past 2 years. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. All Britons will be called on to swear allegiance to King Charles III at his coronation, an oath previously reserved for British nobility, in a move that has upset anti-royalists. The office of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, who will lead the coronation ceremony on Saturday, 6th of May, at Westminster Abbey, announced on Saturday, 29th of April, that the traditional Homage of Peers, during which representatives of the nobility kneel before the king and pledge their allegiance to him, would be scrapped. Instead, the ceremony would include a homage of the people, with the Archbishop of Canterbury calling on all people in the United Kingdom and other places where King Charles III is the head of state to swear their allegiance. The Archbishop will call on all persons in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland and the other realms and territories to make their homage to the new king. British parliamentarians, but also Canadians, since the British sovereign is their head of state, already swear allegiance to the monarch when they take office. On Sunday, 30th of April, several elected representatives interviewed in the British media indicated that they will take the new oath during the coronation ceremony. However, plans to ask the public to pledge their allegiance to the new king during the coronation have been branded offensive, tone-deaf, and a gesture that holds the British people in contempt by an anti-monarchy group. The introduction of the new oath is one of the changes in the centuries-old ceremony, which the palace wants to evolve, particularly to reflect the country's diversity. The last coronation was 70 years ago, when King Charles III's mother, Queen Elizabeth II, was crowned. She died in September of last year, aged 96. At Saturday's ceremony, women bishops will take part for the first time, as well as representatives of non-Christian faiths. Another new feature is a text will be read out in the languages of the other nations of the United Kingdom, that is Welsh, Scottish Gaelic, and Irish Gaelic.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.